B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, July 17th, 2020. As we head into another weekend with nowhere to go and nothing to do. We're finally getting some national coverage of the situation in Portland, Oregon. Today is day 50 of protests that started after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And it's been kind of on the down low in terms of any coverage beyond the local media in Portland, Oregon. But President Trump dispatched a group of armed federal officers who remind me of those who showed up at Lafayette Square in June of this year, around the time that Trump, dallied across the street to have his picture taken clutching a Bible as if he'd never done so before in front of the partially burned out church. And following that evening, when, of course, in preparation for Trump's photo op, they had cleared the street, brutalizing nonviolent protesters. And then the streets of Washington were filled with riot gear, heavily armed federal officials. We later found out some were prison guards, some were from the U.S. Marshal's office, some are armed officers of the Department of Homeland Security. And now there is a similar deployment in Portland. It is centered around the federal building, which the federal government has authority over. But over the past week, it started with the report of a nonviolent protester who was seriously wounded by a less lethal weapon that was discharged in very close range and led to his hospitalization. And a few people sent me the video, and I kind of considered it an isolated incident. But as we're learning more, we have a federal occupation of downtown Portland, Oregon. This was done without any consultation with the mayor, who also is the local police commissioner, with the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, with either of the Democratic senators who represent Oregon, or the local Congress member. And Trump has bragged about how they have brought quiet to the streets of Portland. Well, we have video evidence that's surfacing now, and mainstream coverage by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others. But I prefer to start with the independent media outlet, Mint Press, and its talented reporter, Alan McLeod. He writes, one video shows individuals in battle fatigues pull up beside a small group of people on a deserted Portland street, arresting one man without identifying themselves or saying anything, and stuffing him into the back of a minivan. And at the Oregon Justice Resource Center, he quotes Juan Chavez, it sounds more like abduction. It sounds like they're kidnapping people off the streets. It's like stop and frisk meets Guantanamo Bay. So Homeland Security has justified its invasion, claiming that Portland had been under siege, it's now 50 straight days, by what they call a violent mob, while local political leaders refuse to restore order to protect their city. DHS calls them violent anarchists who have wrecked the city. But while there is some graffiti on the federal building and it's estimated to cost $50,000 to clean it up, that is hardly the trigger to send, these are not troops, but federal militias uninvited into what we can call the sovereign city of Portland. So the mayor, Ted Wheeler, as I mentioned, also police commissioner, I don't know how you hold both of those jobs, He said this is clearly a coordinated strategy from the White House. It is irresponsible. It is escalating an already tense situation. Remove your heightened troop presence now, he said. Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer, referring to the acting director of DHS, says Chad Wolf just arrived in Portland. Here's my message. Go home, Chad, and take your unlawful DHS agents with you. The Trump administration has no place occupying and inciting violence in our community. So the incident I referred to was last Saturday as Donovan LaBella, a 26-year-old protester, shot outside of the Hatfield Federal Courthouse. And he was holding a speaker, a big Bluetooth speaker or a boombox that may have been used to, you know, speak to a crowd. But he was holding it over his head with both hands, so it was clear that he was not armed and that the speaker posed no threat had he hurled it at the federal officers who were about 20 feet away. So one of those officers fired a tear gas round. And I will note that Oregon has passed a law saying that tear gas cannot be used in Portland against protesters except under certain extreme circumstances. But the feds, they don't acknowledge any kind of local authority. So the tear gas canister rolled toward LaBella, and he picked it up, and he didn't throw it, hurl it back at the officers. He, like a slow pitch softball pitch, he threw it underhand so that it dropped about 10 feet away from him. So he was protecting himself, but not putting the officers at any risk. And by the way, they're all wearing gas masks. So a large pool of blood appeared where LaBella fell, and his mother has confirmed that he survived the incident, but he needed facial reconstruction surgery, with doctors inserting a titanium plate into his head. Then we pick up local coverage from public media, Oregon Public Broadcasting. And they take us to the early hours of July 15th, 2 a.m., at that point, law enforcement had not used any tear gas, and both the Portland police and federal law enforcement were staying out of sight. And a young man named Mark Pettibone and his friend Connor O'Shea decided they'd done enough that night. They were heading home. They bumped into a group of people who warned them that folks in camouflage were driving around in unmarked minivans grabbing people off the street. And O'Shea says, I see guys in camo. Four or five of them pop out, open the door, and it was just like, oh, shit. I don't know who you are or what you want with us. So Pettibone and O'Shea were grabbed. They were stuffed into this minivan. And they found out later that they were hauled into the federal building. And it appears they were targeted by federal officers simply for wearing black clothing in the area of a demonstration. So technically, these federal officers do have a legal right to protect federal property. But by hitting the streets in unmarked minivans, they are violating the local authority of the city of Portland and its law enforcement agencies. So Pettibone said at the federal building he was put into a cell. Soon after, two officers came in to read him his Miranda rights. They didn't tell him why he was being arrested or even if he was being arrested. He said they asked him if he wanted to waive his rights. He declined. Also declined to answer questions, said he wanted a lawyer. The interview was terminated, and about 90 minutes later, he was released. He didn't receive any paperwork, a citation, a record of his arrest. I just happened to be wearing black on a sidewalk in downtown Portland at the time, and that, apparently, is grounds for detaining me. So this is creeping police state activity. And coming from the federal government, the Trump administration, the word fascism is not too strong. Again, in Washington, D.C., because of the weird status of the District of Columbia, it's essentially a colony of the federal government. There was a gray area that, you know, apparently permitted Trump to deploy these, you know, patchwork of troops. And Bill Barr was named the commandant of the protection of the Capitol. But there is no such basis for this in Portland, Oregon. And we need to hear howls of protest, not just from protesters in Portland, not just from the local officials, but from all across this country. This should not stand. And finally, the New York Times, as I said, also the Washington Post, they're covering this situation. The Post essentially rewrote the story that I quoted from Oregon Public Broadcasting. But the Times writes it up this way. Mayor Ted Wheeler, who's also a police commissioner, said the federal response was irresponsible, asked for those deployed to stay inside federal buildings or leave the city. The county sheriff, Mike Reese, called the federal response a significant setback in efforts to calm tensions. Governor Kate Brown called it a blatant abuse of power by the federal government. So it is noteworthy that some community leaders in the black community in Portland say that the predominantly white protest crowd has seized an opportunity and detract from the vital efforts needed to reform policing. And I'm not on the ground there. I won't criticize their commentary. But Trump has said that he sent Homeland Security personnel to Portland because the locals couldn't handle it. And local Portland TV station KGW posted answers to questions. How many arrests have the feds made? It's 12 or 13. What can federal officers do that local police can't? The answer here provided, unlike Portland police, subject to a court order limiting the use of tear gas, federal agents can use a variety of crowd control devices. It's not clear what type of less lethal munitions federal officers are equipped with, although previous reporting indicates the feds have used CS, tear gas, on the streets of Portland. And who are these federal officers? Well, the TV station says they are drawn from the U.S. Marshals, the Federal Protective Service, Customs and Border Protection, and Homeland Security Investigations. Lead agency, U.S. Marshals Service. Now, down the road a few clicks in Eugene, Oregon, is the University of Oregon, and that is centered in Lane County. And my friend Peter Laufer teaches journalism at Oregon. He's been there for about 10 years. And he wrote a piece for the local weekly paper exposing the dark history of the man for whom Lane County is named, Joseph Joe Lane. Well, he was a brigadier general in the U.S. military, an enthusiastic warrior in President James Polk's manifest destiny-fueled war of conquest, the war that stole half of Mexico and expanded U.S. territory across the Southwest. In return for his service, James Polk appointed Lane the governor of the Oregon Territory. When Oregon Territory became a state in 1859, Lane went back to Washington as one of the first senators. A year later, he was on the ballot as vice president running mate for Kentucky slave owner John Breckinridge. They ran a pro-slavery campaign. Lincoln beat them. As a U.S. senator, Lane defended the Confederacy's right to secede from the Union. His son John quit West Point and signed up for the Confederate Army. During Lane's political career, both the territorial and state constitutions forbade the residency here of what those documents termed Negroes and mulattoes. So, he says, we've got a sorry heritage living in a county named after Joe Lane. What should we do? Well, changing the name is a likely suggestion. Then he said, well, to reduce the costs of a name change, what if we replace Joe with somebody else named Lane? How about Lois Lane? That's a Superman joke. And then he settles on Harry Lane, who is the grandson of Joe Lane, but a righteous individual who broke the family chain of racist, imperialist brutality. And he later was an early supporter of women's suffrage. He too served in the U.S. Senate in the 19-teens, was opposed to World War I. And so he says the commissioners of Lane County are currently considering establishing a task force to change the name of Lane County to Lane County. All right, next we go back to Seattle, where our correspondent Joan Aleto has filed an important report today. While Seattle Mayor and ex-prosecutor Jenny Durkan has publicly blamed her troubles on the lone socialist member of the city council, Kashama Sawant, who represents the district that includes the CHOP, Democrats and progressive Democrats are now making their voices heard through letters and resolutions from Democratic Party legislative district committees. They are declaring their independence from Mayor Durkan as detailed resolutions from three districts now call for the mayor to resign, be impeached, or face defeat at the polls next year. These resolutions currently represent 3 out of 5 Seattle-heavy legislative districts calling for her immediate removal by any Democratic means necessary. Investigating the claim of whether Socialist City Council member Kashama Sawant was involved or not, a local paper, The Stranger, asked 36th District Democrats Policy Director Summer Stinson about that. No, these resolutions were written by the Democrats, Stinson responded. As much as Mayor Durkan would like to believe she has one person questioning her leadership, she needs to face the harsh reality that she has many, many Democrats and unions asking for her to resign. The resolution recites the Democratic Party platform in Washington State calling for the demilitarization of police forces, which contrasts with ex-prosecutor Durkan's support for police actions as being reasonable. The 43rd District Dems tweeted in part, Seattle deserves a mayor who will protect our protesters and journalists from police violence and who will work to defund the Seattle Police Department. Jasmine Smith of the 36th District said the resolution was first drafted 6 weeks ago. She said she and others were witnessing one thing through live streams of protest and hearing another at Durkan's press conferences. Mayor Durkan was lying to us, Smith said, and gaslighting us about things where we had video evidence where that wasn't the case. It created this culture in our city of being terrified of the institutions of power. In a June open letter from progressive leaders, it states, Mayor Durkan has repeatedly proven that she is either unwilling or unable to exercise control over the Seattle Police Department. As of today, over 15,000 Democrats have signed on to a petition supporting the letter and are identified by their district membership. Democrats are saying this is a rare move in Seattle, noting that a prior mayor who was the subject of child sex abuse allegations did not face multiple resolutions for removal from office. In the 37th District, member Devin Glazer said, you can only pepper spray so many community members before even the non-radical members of your community are fed up. He described his district as the core Roberts Rules of Order, boring resolution-passing constituents of the Democratic Party. They voted 2-1 to call for Durkan's resignation. Asked about these three resolutions, Mayor Durkan's office once again singled out Kashama Sawant. When asked by The Stranger reporter Natalie Graham what the connective tissue was between Democratic Party resolutions and the Socialist Sawant, the mayor's office clarified only that Sawant has previously offered to write articles of impeachment. And Jonah closes with this comment, it looks like Seattle Democrats have already written the guts of articles of impeachment. And he includes a link that will be in the attached text of his report that is embedded in the show file of this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And the resolution, one of them, cites a number of murders that are blamed on the Seattle police. I mean, the list is quite long. Charlena Lyles, Shea Taylor, Sean Feuer, Andrew Law, Austin Derby, Cody Spafford, and it goes on. There isn't a time reference of how many years these police killings occurred over, but it is quite a litany there. So then there are a bunch of whereas clauses. Durkin has repeatedly used her powers to declare restrictive curfews, that she didn't rein in the police for using tear gas. She has shown no ability to rein in the police department or protect police peaceful protesters, that she tried to get an early exit from the 2012 consent decree between the Justice Department and the Seattle PD. Therefore, be it resolved that 36 district Democrats call on Mayor Jenny Durkin to immediately resign as mayor. And if not, that the city council should use their powers of impeachment to remove her. And if not, defeat her at the polls next year. So, what I just referred to in Portland and in Seattle are real grassroots expressions. The protests are not orchestrated from afar. They're not ginned up by moneyed people using social media. But I want to praise The Intercept today under the byline of Mara Vistendahl for an update on the Doerr brothers, D-O-R-R. They come from a large family, and their father was a pro-life and also anti-school protester for many years. There are a bunch of kids, I think like nine of them. But four brothers, Aaron, Chris, Matthew, and Ben Doerr, they helped launch the protest to reopen states, the anti-lockdown protest that often featured heavily armed individuals traipsing through state capitals across the country. So the Doerr brothers, they range in age from 29 to 40. They have ties to Tea Party figures like Michelle Bachmann, and also to Ron Paul. Their dad was a big Ron Paul supporter. The article details the approximately two dozen nonprofits and Facebook groups run by the Doerrs across 11 states. Groups like the Idaho Second Amendment Alliance, the Iowa Pro-Life Action, the Trump Club of Ohio. Often their tactics are crude, but they have at least 325,000 followers on social media, and they appear to profit from this. Now, they may have some of their own money that they put in to seed these operations, but it appears they generate contributions and find other ways to generate revenue from these political activities. And to be fair, they are further to the right of the NRA when it comes to Second Amendment rights. They think the NRA is a wimpy outfit. Now, on the extreme other side of this, the Washington Post today has exposed the identity of the man who was responsible for trolling on social media, posting fake information about an Antifa rally at Gettysburg on July the 4th, where the big feature was going to be burning of the American flag. And the guy responsible is 38-year-old Adam Rahuba, who describes himself as a Bernie Sanders supporter who just got sick and tired of the right-wing nuts. So he has been exposed by the Post as the anonymous figure behind a number of social media hoaxes, including the Gettysburg incident. He seeded rumors of an organized effort to report Trump supporters for supposed child abuse. He promoted a purported grassroots campaign to confiscate Americans' guns. And so the operation at Gettysburg featured an ad saying, "Antifa presents 4th of July flag burning, Gettysburg Cemetery, children welcome, Antifa face painting." No bikers, militias, or other so-called patriots. And it even included a phone number where you could call to get more information. I don't know if it was a real number. Hundreds of counter-protesters, including skinheads, flocked to Gettysburg to confront the non-existent flag burners. So it's a lengthy story on Rahuba. He apparently sleeps on a couch in a friend's apartment in Harmony, Pennsylvania, where he said he has 13 aliases and social media accounts, and he's been doing this since 2013. "I guess I'm outed," he said. So, those are two different groups who are intentionally contributing disinformation to a very divided political landscape here in the United States. And then comes Rush Limbaugh. Now, I have a little sympathy for Rush. He appears to be dying of cancer. He doesn't talk about it on his radio show. He accepts well wishes, but that's about as far as he goes. And he appears to be determined he's on some mission from God to get Trump reelected. And so today, his rant was so unhinged, it falls well into the disinformation category. And he tried to school his listeners, "Don't worry about Trump, you know, and all his antics." He said, "This election is the most important ever, and it's not about Trump. It's about defeating the Marxist-communist agenda of the Democrats." And in his convoluted rant, he made it seem like Joe Biden has embraced every element of the Bernie Sanders agenda, which is completely false. It's a very limited cherry-picking of some of the Sanders platform. And then Rush went into a rant about how liberals don't compromise. They want to destroy the Constitution. And I consider that to be projection, because it's the Republicans who, their idea of compromise is when the Democrats cave in 100%. And I believe they are the real risk to the Constitution, and that they broke the Constitution through the stonewalling of the impeachment effort earlier this year. And I was prepared, if Bernie Sanders had been the nominee, to hear this Marxist communist bullshit. But even Limbaugh admitted in his convoluted way that Biden himself is not a Marxist or a communist. And here's the evidence. His campaign has raked in $242 million in the last month alone. And because he is now the unchallenged, likely nominee, a lot of that money doesn't have big limits on it. People can give up to $600,000. And so, the widow of Steve Jobs, Loreen Powell Jobs, has kicked in $500,000. Meg Whitman, the former Republican candidate for governor, she spent $120 million of her fortune trying to buy the governor's office in Sacramento. George Soros, oh, he gives a lot of people the creeps. Jeffrey Katzenberg, a co-founder of Facebook, Dustin Moskovitz. Then there are the Allied Political Action Committees. The Biden Action Fund has $11.5 million. American Bridge has raised more than $15 million, including a contribution of $1.25 million from Philip Ragon, the founder of a software company. Another million-dollar donation here, $1 million there. You don't need to hear the names. $1.25 million here. Is that Marxist? Is that communist? Now, if Sanders were the presumptive nominee, we'd be hearing about the massive individual donations of $18 or $28 on average. And I guess you could then say, well, that's those commie Marxist people who have been in the streets. But Joe Biden doesn't come anywhere close to the misrepresentations and mischaracterizations that come out of Rush Limbaugh, who's widely believed by his millions of daily radio listeners. And we're now learning that the coronation of Joe Biden will be a much more modest affair. Instead of 50,000 people converging in Milwaukee, the organizers of the Democratic National Convention are now inviting as few as 300 people, and that includes some members of the media. It's all going to be Zoom, pre-recorded videos. I doubt if anybody will watch. But convention planners last night sent an email directing all members of Congress and delegates to stay away from the convention. So it's going to be a backroom deal. According to the New York Times, the best case scenario is a polished program that's a mix of live speeches, pre-taped videos, and small events held at satellite locations in battleground states and landmarks across the country. Now, that's going to be a yawner. But unlike the plans that are being scaled down from Trump's ideas, it will not be masses of unmasked people risking spreading the coronavirus. Good news for progressives, as Representative Elliot Engel, 16-term congressman from New York, has conceded. The vote count based on the absentees now shows that Jamal Bowman, a former middle school principal who's never served in office before, has defeated the 73-year-old chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And he is an out progressive aligned with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So this is good news. And speaking of AOC, she's joined a new campaign to push New York Governor Cuomo to tax billionaires who live in New York State. We have a count. There's something like 119 billionaires in New York State. And they want to tax the unrealized capital gains of those one percenters. The money would be redirected to workers who are not eligible for unemployment insurance or federal bailout money. Interesting idea. So it's been a week of hacks. I was not one of the people on Twitter hacked. I don't have a verified account. And we are getting confirmed reports that Trump himself was not hacked on Twitter. But over at Twitter headquarters, where they got a tax break to keep the company in San Francisco, Jack Dorsey and his team are scrambling to figure out what happened. And it appears that one of their senior people in engineering or management had their phone or other device hacked by the attackers, and they are unable to rule out insider complicity. Somebody who may have been paid off or have a political motive to compromise the security at Tweet HQ. And there's still a lot of drama in the coverage of the claim by the National Security Agency that they've discovered that Cozy Bear, Russian intelligence, has been trying to hack into the websites and emails at various laboratories where they're working on a COVID-19 vaccine. I meant to say vaccine, not vaccine. Sorry. And this is just more of this over-the-top Russophobia. And to give you an example, last night on the news hour, they trotted out Dmitry Alperovitch. He's one of the leaders of CrowdStrike, the company with a lot of FBI connections that was hired by the DNC to claim that Russia hacked their servers and gave that to WikiLeaks. And we now know that there is no evidence, zero evidence, to support the exfiltration of DNC data by anybody including Russian hackers. So, even as the coverage is peppered with disclaimers like this one, attributing such attacks, however, is imprecise, an ambiguity that Moscow takes advantage of in denying its responsibility, as it did Thursday. Well, the same is true of 2016. That we don't have evidence that Russia did this, and, as I explained yesterday, and as Alperovitch said on the PBS NewsHour last night, this is pretty routine hacking on the part of Russia. And they may be just comparing notes to see if they may be ahead of us in development of a vaccine or not. And as we'll get to in a moment, the whole efficacy of a vaccine is based on antibodies, and the current research is not encouraging. But let's turn to Yasha Levine, Russian emigre, who writes in his newsletter today. He said, first, about Cozy Bear. It does not exist. This evil Russian hacker group is a fiction made up by CrowdStrike, a privatized spy security firm, in order to drum up business and increase its valuation. I repeat, Cozy Bear does not exist, and I wrote about this 3 years ago. The thing about these security firms is that they frequently tailor their findings to meet the demands of the market, and they do this by practicing a very cynical, profit-driven forensic science. They reverse-engineer things to produce results. First, they decide on the guilty party, the Russians or the Chinese or the Iranians, and then they find the evidence that confirms this assumption. Levine continues, claims about cyber attacks and hacks are a perfect vehicle for spy-fed, xenophobic, and nationalistic propaganda. These attacks all happen within computer systems. The physical evidence showing that they happened boils down to a bit of data in some log file somewhere. That data can be faked, it can be invented, and it can be interpreted in pretty much any way the people doing the interpreting want. This COVID vaccine hacking story is a perfect example. Nothing actually happened. Even the spies pushing this story ultimately admit that. Yet to them, this nothing is evidence of something. Something huge and dangerous. And all the way from Australia, Caitlin Johnstone weighs in. Published today at Consortium News. She writes, today, mainstream media is reporting what is arguably the single dumbest Russia vape story of all time against some very stiff competition. She says, first of all, how many more completely unsubstantiated government agency allegations about Russian nefariousness are we, the public, going to accept from the corporate mass media? And she recites the history of the discredited Russiagate narrative. Then she says, the news story doesn't even claim that these supposed Russian hackers even succeeded in doing whatever they were supposed to have been doing in this supposed cyber attack. Then she says, this is a vaccine which does not even exist at this point in time. And research which was supposedly hacked may never lead to one. And she adds, perhaps most importantly, how obnoxious and idiotic is it that coronavirus vaccine secrets are even a thing? This is a global pandemic which is hurting all of us. Scientists should be free to collaborate with other scientists anywhere in the world to find a solution to this problem. Nobody has any business keeping secrets from the world about this virus or any possible vaccine or treatment. I want to mention that we continue to have a little bit of funding remaining in the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. And if you would like to request a $100 grant, there is still time. Just send your request to Peter at peterbcollins.com. Explain why you need $100 and what you might use it for. And as you know, I've only turned down one request so far. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, age 87. Was in the hospital earlier this week, and she now is disclosing that she has liver cancer, and that on May 19, she began a course of chemotherapy. She said the chemotherapy is yielding positive results. Satisfied that my treatment course is now clear, I am providing this information. And she noted that she remains fully up to the job, and she has participated in all of the recent court deliberations. Steve Mnuchin, the king of foreclosures here in California before he was recruited into the Trump administration, is telling us that, well, he told Congress today, that the Paycheck Protection Program loans should all be forgiven under a certain amount. And the number floated is about $150,000. I'm in favor of that. But it's likely the Republicans will make it a complete amnesty, although they're opposed to amnesty. So they can cover for all of the corporate pigs who came to the trough to take free money from the federal government. Mnuchin also called on Congress to work with the Trump administration to pass additional stimulus legislation. He wants to target it to industries that have been hardest hit, as well as smaller businesses, low to middle income families. He didn't say anything about the black businesses that have been largely excluded from the money bailouts coming from Washington. In addition, we are learning that the big banksters, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, have set aside a total of $33 billion to cover potential loan losses. That's up from $10 billion just a couple of months ago. And this means that they are preparing for a meltdown. We know that if the expanded unemployment runs out at the end of this month and is not renewed for vulnerable Americans, that will lead to a wave of foreclosures and evictions, more homeless people, and more demand for bailouts from Washington. Also, we have figures now, 3,600 companies have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the first half of this year, more than any since the year 2012. The Supreme Court yesterday, in one of those decisions that they don't explain, they just turned away an appeal from Florida related to the pretextual law that Republicans imposed to block the will of the voters, which was to allow ex-felons to vote. The Republicans redefined completion of a sentence to include paying any fines or fees that were still due. And in dissent, Sotomayor, joined by Ginsburg and Kagan, said that the order continues a trend of condoning disenfranchisement. This court's order prevents thousands of otherwise eligible voters from participating in Florida's primary election simply because they are poor. And to me, this is an extension of the very obvious Republican voter suppression tactics embraced by the five Republican appointees to the U.S. Supreme Court. And here is a potential felon who still has the right to vote. He is a Republican congressman from Kansas, Steve Watkins, and he has been charged with three felonies and a misdemeanor related to illegally voting in a 2019 local race. This is voter fraud. And Trump wants you to believe that there are millions of cases of voter fraud every year. But it's as rare as an actual hair on the top of Donald Trump's head. We don't have details of the charges. They say that in 2019, Watkins changed his voter registration address to a local UPS store in Topeka. He made the change to hide the fact that he was living with his parents at the time, and it put him into a different district. He's now a first-term congressman representing the eastern part of Kansas. He faces charges of voting without being qualified, marking or transmitting more than one ballot, and obstructing law enforcement. Yeah, we got to root out that voter fraud. Definitely. So the numbers just keep climbing. And yesterday, more than 75,600 positive tests for coronavirus were reported. The number of daily cases has more than doubled since June 24th. And four states set single-day records: Idaho, Nevada, Oregon, and Texas. Seven others reached records for the number of fatalities: Alabama, Arizona, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Utah. Kentucky is seeing cases rise, and they have a record number of children aged under five testing positive. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. First of all, our numbers. Worldwide, 13.8 million cases, almost 600,000 deaths now. Across the United States, 3.6 million cases, 139,000 139,000 deaths, almost. Experts estimate that uncounted COVID-19 cases number in the tens of millions, and lacking information about them hampers our understanding of the pandemic. The article in USA Today tells the stories of individuals who were diagnosed by a doctor after a presumed false negative, or who were unable to get tested at all. Many of those interviewed by USA Today said they were seriously ill before the pandemic was declared, and because their coronavirus antibodies might dissipate before tests are developed, doctors are saying that we have to expect that the count of cases is much higher. Italy has found tens of thousands of cases, literally at random. Health officials in hazmat suits conduct random screenings for COVID-19 at shopping malls and other places, one of the most proactive ways that Italians have found to beat the pandemic, at least for now. Italy went from worst-case scenario to best practice with a strict nationwide lockdown, mandated face coverings inside all public buildings, and here is what is so striking now: rigorous random screening. Once an asymptomatic case is confirmed, the Italian health authorities engage in vigorous contact tracing, made much easier by mandates requiring patrons of restaurants and other places to leave phone numbers or emails about where they have been. COVID-19 could cause male infertility, could be transmitted sexually. A study published last month in JAMA analyzed semen samples of 38 COVID-19 patients and found the presence of the virus in 15% of the men. According to a researcher, the pathological impact on the tested is underscored by data showing active cases dramatically reduce testosterone to luteinizing hormones. Reduction in testosterone has a significant impact on the body's responses to the cells that stimulate the secretion of sex steroids. Also, the fertility rate is being impacted. Researchers at the University of Washington showed the global fertility rate has dropped by nearly half since 2017, and their study, published in The Lancet, projects that it will fall below 1.7 by the year 2100. It doesn't have anything to do with sperm counts or the usual things that come to mind when discussing fertility. Instead, it is being driven by more women in education and work, as well as greater access to contraception, leading to women choosing to have fewer children. 23 nations, including Spain and Japan, are expected to see their populations drop by half as early as 2100. Different strains of the new coronavirus could be infecting people in some communities at once, pushing up the death toll from the disease, according to a new study. This comes from the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Variations on the pathogens circulating in Europe and the United States could be causing serial infections in some people, confusing the immune system and triggering an overreaction or even death. If one strain is still highly prevalent, the situation should be closely monitored, especially for severe disease occurrence, and social distancing should still be maintained to make sure the second strain doesn't get introduced. That's a statement from a professor who presented the findings. At the Center for Public Integrity, a document prepared for the White House Coronavirus Task Force but not publicized suggests more than a dozen states should revert to more stringent protective measures, limiting social gatherings to 10 or fewer, closing bars, gyms, and asking residents to wear masks at all times. The director of Harvard's Global Health Initiative said he thought the information and recommendations were mostly good. The 18 states that are included in the red zone for cases in the document: Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, California, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, Nevada, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. Bernie Sanders and Andy Slavitt have published an op-ed. They announced a proposal called Masks for All to make high-quality masks available on an equitable basis to every single person in the country at no cost. They cite the University of Washington projections that widespread use of masks in the United States could save 40,000 lives by November 1st. And they write, President Trump has recklessly made masks a political football, but public surveys suggest that Americans, by a good-sized majority, are very open to wearing masks. This bill would help make clear the public health necessity for masks once and for all. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a no-sail order for cruise ships, this will extend at least until September 30th. I don't know anybody who would want to take a cruise right now. Florida's Emergency Operations Center has closed after 12 employees tested positive for COVID-19. They shut down their Emergency Operations Center Thursday. It is typically activated during hurricanes and operates around the clock. The positive cases were discovered after the state started testing employees twice a week in June. All 12 were not displaying symptoms and passed the screening protocols previously. Chuck Woolery, who has been outspoken and tweeting like a son of a gun, his skepticism and contempt for the whole virus and wearing masks and all that, he's eating a little crow now. The former game show host has announced that his son has tested positive. They're saying that he is fine and asymptomatic. Okay. When it hits home, it hits very close to home. 60% of Americans disapprove of Trump's handling of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Surveys released Friday found that 38% of Americans approve, down from 46% in May and 51% in March. His disapproval rating is up from 53% in May and 45% in March. As I mentioned, the preliminary research into antibodies formed by people who have tested positive for COVID-19 are not promising. New revelations that permanent immunity as a consequence of a vaccine or having had the virus may not be possible, because the human body does not retain the antibodies that build up during infections, meaning there may be no lasting immunity to COVID-19 after people recover, and you could be at risk for reinfection. They quote Nevin Krogan, a molecular biologist at the University of San Francisco. I just don't see a vaccine coming anytime soon. One of these things we've seen recently, and it's kind of disturbing, is that people do have antibodies, but the antibodies are waning quickly. At King's College of London, a recent study showed that antibody levels peak 3 weeks after the onset of symptoms and then dramatically decline. Potent antibodies were found in 60% of the patients, but only 17% retained the same potency 3 months later. There's a similar study conducted in China. And I don't have it in front of me, so I won't try to quote it to you, but Anthony Fauci, I heard a radio report on my way to work this morning, where he was saying optimistic things about how we're moving to phase three of clinical trials of a certain potential vaccine. But that flies in the face of this research on antibodies. The city of Asheville, North Carolina, is moving forward toward a form of reparations. The city council has approved a plan to provide funding to programs geared toward increasing home ownership and business and career opportunities for black residents as part of a reparations initiative. It was passed unanimously on Tuesday night. That's not the only place. In Providence, Rhode Island, the mayor signed an executive order Wednesday to commence a truth-telling and reparations process. And here in California, a bill creating a task force to develop reparation proposals for African Americans was passed by our lower house of the legislature in June. In a kind of military dance, the Pentagon has issued a memo that essentially bans displays of the Confederate flag on military installations all across the world. But in order to avoid poking the bear, our tweeter-in-chief, the carefully worded memo does not mention the Confederate flag and doesn't explicitly ban it. It just says that you cannot fly flags that are not listed as approved in this memo. That's what they have to do to deal with the idiot in the White House these days. And as you know, if you are a regular listener, I don't care much about professional sports, including the NFL. And I'm shocked when some people think that it's an institution on par with religion, academia, and government. But the team that just announced that it will no longer call the Washington Redskins, are now facing a new scandal. Because a group of female employees have come forward alleging sexual harassment and verbal abuse in the workplace. They have named names. And I don't find this surprising. In a high testosterone workplace where the, ethic is to deny that the term Redskins was offensive to Native Americans, well, you would expect serious tolerance for violations of sexual harassment standards and just ordinary respect for individuals who are not white male football players. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.